5. Public radio works when you help support it. Give us a call at 1-866-677-5869. I'm Steve Scherr with Deborah Wong.
Hey, Steve.
Deborah, you were saying that you're the hard news person, and so you're hitting a little harder, a little faster. And I'm saying, yes, let's keep hitting it hard. Don't slow down. We're not kicking back here.
No, absolutely not.
We are rolling forward towards the end of this goal.
We have a goal for weekday. We have a goal of $19,000 that we need to raise between now and 11 o'clock. Sounds like a lot of money. We can do it with your help. We've got a great program coming up. Jeffrey Toobin.
Jeffrey Toobin is going to talk about his book.
Yep, and actually, as a special thank you gift for this hour, we have Jeffrey Toobin's new book. Have you read it?
Yeah. The Oath.
Is it good?
Yeah. He's positing that John Roberts has a conservative agenda, and he is a slow and methodical radical at dismantling the precedents that have been established by the Supreme Court over the last 200 years. And Barack Obama is a conservative, keep everything status quo, getting in the way, trying to slow things down of this juggernaut.
Well, if that sounds interesting to you, for your pledge of $125, you can have one of Jeffrey Toobin's new books, The Oath. We have 10 of these available for the first 10 of you who call and pledge $125 at 206-543-9595. That's 206-543-9595.
You know, if you haven't called yet and you're thinking, well, why should I call and support public radio? Haven't we made the case already? Haven't we told you why?
Tell them again.
Public radio exists to provide you with quality news and information to help you become a more informed citizen of this country, educated and informed. That is our charge. Our charge is not to get the most listeners possible and sell you the most products. Our charge is to get people to learn, to understand, and to be educated about what's happening. If we succeed in that, it's because many, many people have supported public radio's mission and mandate with their hard-earned dollars. Just as simple as that. And you can do the same thing. If you've never been a member before, you can join us now. Help build up this community that's been built up, will continue to go because of your support.
Think about the times that you've said, hey, I heard this great story on weekday. I heard a great interview on weekday. That you've emailed around a podcast that you happened across. It's a conversation starter. You know, the things that you hear on this show will inspire you, will inform you, will keep you kind of thinking throughout the day about all the great stuff that you've heard. 206-543-9595. Pledge $125. Take away one of Jeffrey Toobin's new books, The Oath. We're going to hear from him this hour. Make sure that you get your pledge in early. We've got 10 of these. Nine available. One has already gone out the door. Nine of these are available. 206-543-9595.
It's like kicking the tires. You can listen to the interview first and then say, okay, I'm ready to go. Or you can just say, no, I like that model. I know I've experienced that model already. You can join us. Who else we're going to hear from today? Buddy Guy, because we just had to run a little bit of that interview with the great Buddy Guy, the great blues man.
Great.
So we're going to hear a little bit of that. And then Vaughn Palmer was in town. He came down to see a movie at the Cinerama, and then he's heading up to Bellingham to talk to the Canadian Studies. So Vaughn Palmer came by a little earlier, an hour ago, and we talked. But we got to sit across the table from him, which is rare and fun. If you appreciate what regulars do for us every Wednesday when they volunteer their time to come in, Robert Horton, Vaughn Palmer, Michael Parks, if you appreciate learning all sorts of new information, join us, 206-543-9595.
Support for KUOW comes from PacMed's 9 neighborhood locations, acknowledging October as National Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Prevention is part of the cure. Same-day screening mammogram appointments at the Beacon Hill and Canyon Park clinics. More information at pacmed.org or at 1-888-4-PACMED.
KUOW would like to acknowledge the businesses that have donated food and beverages throughout our pledge drive, especially Stumptown Coffee Roasters, The Bagel Deli, Top Pot Donuts, and Seattle's own shortbread and classic cookies. Thank you for supporting KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from AdHost Data Centers, locally owned, offering server co-location, including quarter, half, and full cabinets. Tours of a new secure data center in downtown Seattle are now available. Information online at AdHost, AdHost.com.
the nickname he's had for a long time is No Drama Obama. I mean, he is not someone who likes confrontation. He is not someone who, you know, sees himself as a partisan warrior.
This stranger walked by one Thursday or Friday evening and said, "Son, I see you sitting there every evening. I bet if you had a guitar, you would learn how to play." And I said, "I guess so."
The great Buddy Guy and how he learned how to play the guitar. And Jeffrey Toobin starting us out, talking about his new book. Young, ambitious Harvard Law School graduates, alumni of the Harvard Law Review, President Obama and Chief Justice Roberts share many similarities, but it's their political differences that are shaping the Supreme Court and the administration. In his new book, The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court, author Jeffrey Toobin argues that Justice Roberts is now in a position to move his judicial and political agenda forward. The ground has shifted, and it is Roberts, the Republican activist, vying for the influence on America's political direction, with President Obama, the Democratic conservative, trying to hold on to the status quo consensus that's been in place for the most of the past 200 years. Jeffrey Toobin is an author, a lawyer, a regular contributor to The New Yorker. He's also a legal analyst for CNN. His new book is The Oath. And the court is starting out today, hearing a case about affirmative action that Toobin says is going to be huge for its term.
Well, it's a very interesting case from the University of Texas, where a woman who was denied admission claimed that the fact that race is used as one factor in the admission of some students to the University of Texas is a violation of her rights and is a violation of the Constitution. It's obviously very important because it could affect affirmative action in admissions at universities across the country. But it's also important because the court decided nearly the exact same case in 2003 and said that it was okay to consider race. Justice O'Connor's opinion in the Grutter case out of the University of Michigan said that race could be considered as one factor among many. And so this case could really be a very good illustration of just how much the court has gotten more conservative since O'Connor left and was replaced by Samuel Alito.
How does this case relate to the decision they made on the Seattle case and the related case?
Well, I think you saw in the Seattle and Louisville cases, which Chief Justice Roberts wrote, is a real suspicion on his part of any use of race by the government in making any sorts of decisions. Those cases involved school boards in those two cities where one factor, not the only factor, it was sort of a tiebreaker factor, in where students wound up going to school was, you know, preserving some racial balance. And the court struck that down as unconstitutional. And I think you got a very clear signal from Chief Justice Roberts that he just does not like the use of race at all in education.
Jeffrey Toobin is author, lawyer, regular contributor to The New Yorker, a staff writer there. He's also a legal analyst for CNN. His new book is The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. So let me take a step aside for a minute and ask you about the debate. And I'm curious about if you saw in the way the president presented himself in that debate something of the way the president presents himself as a law professor, a thinker, and as president.
You know, there was something of that. The nickname he's had for a long time is No Drama Obama. I mean, he is not someone who likes confrontation. He is not someone who, you know, sees himself as a partisan warrior. And when he took over the presidency, one area where he thought he could sort of lower the temperature between Democrats and Republicans was the area of judicial appointments. He would consult with the Republicans. He would give them a voice in judicial appointments. And thus, confirmations would become easier. Well, he tried that and he had his head handed to him. The Republicans have been very obstructive of his nominees. He has not pushed the issue. He has not forced a confrontation. He has not even filled all the seats he could fill. And I think in the debate, we saw, you know, that certain passivity that has not served him well in that part of his presidency. And you know, I think obviously he just had an off night. And I suspect he'll do better in future debates. But also I suspect that there is a little bit of a window into his character.
In not fighting with the Congress over the court appointments and in leaving these vacancies, what benefit does he get from that? And also, which is more to your point, what reason does he have for that?
Well, again, this goes back to Obama as a law student. You know, Obama has been a tremendous beneficiary, as he very much acknowledges, of the civil rights movement, of the legal victories won by Thurgood Marshall and Charles Hamilton Houston and the like. But he is someone who believes that political change comes about because of elections, not because of lawsuits. And you know, Barack Obama was president of the Harvard Law Review. He could have had a Supreme Court clerkship if he wanted one. But instead, he went back to Chicago and ran for office in short order, ran for the state Senate. And this is what he really believes in, is political change as the vehicle for social change. And he wrote in his book, Audacity of Hope, that he thinks liberals sometimes put too much faith in the courts. And he doesn't put that much faith in the courts. He puts faith in elections. And thus, he has not put that much emphasis on judicial appointments. Now, I hasten to add, he's had a very busy 3.5 years. He's had a lot on his plate. He's had 2 very successful Supreme Court nominations. So it's not like he's blown off the whole subject. But I think the lack of evidence is somewhat revealing of his character and his political views.
When you say that he sees more of a better avenue through the political process, does that mean he thinks the courts – what does he mean – what does that mean he thinks the courts can and can't do?
For example, I mean, there have been a lot of cases about whether the courts can order school districts to spend more money to, you know, equalize funding between school districts. There have been a lot of court cases about whether courts can order bilingual education, that sort of thing. Obama's attitude is, look, the way to get schools funded properly and the right people funded is to just elect political leaders who'll do it. They don't have to you are never going to have the political constituency for it if you simply rely on persuading judges. You need to persuade people to persuade their elected officials to make that change permanent. I think a lot of people feel that way about the abortion issue too, that Democrats and supporters of the pro-choice position became so fixated on Roe v. Wade that they let conservatives, pro-life, anti-choice people dominate the political debate because the pro-choice people were so fixated on the courts.
Well, President Obama sounds a lot like Antonin Scalia in his view of the court's roles.
Well, you know, they are not as different as they might be. I mean, I think certainly they are different on a lot of issues. But it is true that what it has meant historically to be a judicial conservative is that you believe in deference to the democratically elected branches of government. And what has made the current conservative movement so extraordinary is that they are not advocates of judicial restraint. In fact, they are judicial activists. And when you have cases like Citizens United and healthcare, those are conservatives using the courts for political change. And so the parties have, in a way, switched places.
Jeffrey Toobin has been looking at the courts and the Obama White House in his book, The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. So if that's the president's view of the courts, you have written that John Roberts has a more activist view of the court. What does John Roberts see his role on the Supreme Court as being?
Well, you know, Roberts comes out of a conservative legal and political tradition. And the formative experience of his life was clerking for William Rehnquist and then going into the Reagan administration, working in the White House counsel's office, working in the Justice Department. And, you know, Edwin Meese, the attorney general under Ronald Reagan for a time, you know, created a conservative agenda that remains the conservative agenda to this day. Expand executive power, end racial preferences intended to assist African Americans, lower the barriers between church and state, reverse Roe v. Wade and allow states once again to ban abortion. I think that's John Roberts' agenda. He has a distinct view of all these issues, and you see in his now fairly considerable time as Chief Justice, 6 years, that he's making progress in virtually all of those areas.
And is that that progress you speak of, is that a calculated progress? Like, is he thinking it through as a politician as well?
Well,
as
I mean, I think all justices look at one case at a time, but, you know, the Supreme Court gets to pick and choose which cases it takes. And, you know, there is a judicial philosophy that they all have, different ones, that carry over from case to case. So, you know, I don't think John Roberts sits in his chambers rubbing his hands together thinking, oh, you know, we're going to tear down the following six precedents today. But if you look at his record and if you look at his votes, there is a real ideology at work there, and he's had a lot of success.
So in reading the book, in reading your language, and in reading what people say, you see the president as a true conservative and Roberts as the activist. I think that is
a fair summary of the two of them when it comes to their approach to the Constitution, because, you know, the signature issues, decisions of the Roberts Court, whether it's, you know, ending gun control and giving a new understanding of the Second Amendment, certainly Citizens United, where they overturned the will of Congress in the McCain-Feingold law. And in the Obamacare case, where they almost overturned Obamacare, and here Roberts pulled back from the brink, this is a Supreme Court that is dedicated to change.
That's Jeffrey Toobin. He is a contributing writer for The New Yorker. He is a legal analyst for CNN. He is author of a new book on President Obama and John Roberts called The Oath. We're going to hear more from him in a few minutes. We also had 10 books of his to give away to 10 folks who would call 206-543-9595 or 1-866-677-5869, pledge their support to this public radio station that brings you interviews like this. And then as a thank you, Jeffrey Toobin's book. We have one copy left,
wow.
So that could be yours if you call 206-543-9595. Deborah Wong and I are trying to remind you that public radio works because you have supported it in the past, and now it's time for you to do it again. Or if you've never supported it in the past, we need you to become a new member.
You can become a new member by calling 206-543-9595. The Jeffrey Toobin books are officially gone. Thanks for all of you who called to grab one of those books for your $125 pledge. You can help us meet our challenge for weekday. We're trying to raise $19,000. We can do that with your help. And we've had a lot of people call so far this morning. Jay from Bainbridge Island called. He's a new member, which is great. We should ring a bell when people become new members because that's like a really huge thing for us. Yay! He pledged, this is interesting. He pledged $1.50 for each of the 32 years he's been listening, and that equals $50. Our producers did the math. It's actually $48, but, you know, I guess he rounded up. So you can do that as well. You decide what programs like Weekday are worth to you. You put a number to it, what you can afford, what's comfortable to you, what you'd like to give, and make that call, 206-543-9595.
Maybe you think, I listen to this radio station every day, and I've been listening to it for 30 years. Maybe $15 a year for all the years I've been listening. Maybe $100 for all the years I've been listening. It's what you can afford. It's what you see as valuable to you and whether the service is valuable to you. or not. Gentry said, thanks for the great programming. I listen every morning in the car. Jennifer writes, I love KUOW. It keeps me well informed. I especially appreciate the connection while I'm on maternity leave. Carrie says, I love Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Rick Steves, Splendid Table. If you are one of those people who can list off all the different shows that you have listened to on public radio for the past 32 years or the past 32 months, give us a call and show your support. We want to make this goal of $19,000. The Tubin books are gone. We have many thank you gifts to give you, but those are just that, thank you gifts. The most important gift is the one that you give by supporting this service. 1-866-677-5869.
Or KUOW.org. Maybe you're at work, you're at your computer, you can't make that call right now. Just go over to the website. You can take a look at those thank you gifts. We've got some great pictures, and choose what you'd like to do. It takes about a minute to become a member. Or 206-543-9595.
All right, a little more from Jeffrey Tubin before we get back to reminding you that this is a public radio station and it needs your service as well. Jeffrey Tubin, by the way, is speaking at Benaroya Hall tonight at 7:30. I talked to him late in the afternoon yesterday before he was flying in. He studies the courts, and he talks about the courts on CNN. He talks about the courts in his work in The New Yorker. He's writing about what's happening right now as the court starts its next term. He writes in his book, The Oath. The Oath refers to the White House decision to get Chief Justice Roberts and now President Barack Obama back together soon after the inauguration. You may remember the Chief Justice had flubbed the recitation of the oath of office during the swearing-in ceremony, and some of the president's own legal advisors wondered whether that might mean people will challenge it, whether he was legally sworn in or not. They were wondering if President Obama's opponents would claim it was an illegitimate presidency because it wasn't the verbatim oath out of the Constitution. And given the political tensions of the day, the ongoing birth certificate charges from the right wing in particular, the decision was made to redo the oath of office.
Everybody knows that the oath was botched, but no one has had actually looked into why, what happened. And it's just sort of a crazy series of mistakes and misconnections. And I just thought it was fun and interesting. I also thought it's a good metaphor for the conflict between the two of them. And many of the themes that come up later in the book are raised in the course of the oath controversy and the decision to redo it.
Did it need to be done? Did it need to be redone?
You know, that's a hard question. I think, you know, probably not. Barack Obama almost certainly became president at noon on January 20th, even if he never took the oath at all. The constitutional significance of taking the oath of office is not clear. And there's sort of some fun history with that I go through. And there have been lots of strange administrations of the oath over history. But the White House lawyers recognized that they lived in such a politically incendiary environment that someone might file a lawsuit and some judge might take an interest in it and they might hold a hearing. And can you imagine the distraction it would have been in the first days of Obama's presidency to have someone filing a lawsuit saying he's not really president? And you know, how would you gather evidence? Would Obama have to testify? Would Roberts have to testify? Lawsuits have ways of taking lives of their own. And I think Roberts and the White House lawyers thought that caution was the better part of valor and redoing it would eliminate the problem. But I think the fact that they felt compelled to redo it illustrates just how politically dicey a world they lived in.
You know, you have them wondering about the last phrase and how that should be delivered. How was that phrase finally delivered?
So help you God. First of all, I mean, again, like so many things in the oath, there's a peculiar history to that. You know, the phrase, so help you God, so help me God, is not in the oath. And George Washington, when he first took the oath, is said to have used that phrase, although it's not at all clear that he did. But historically, it's been sort of understood that he said it. And Roberts is, really appears to be the first person to point out that it's not clear whether it's a question or a statement. And, you know, listening to the YouTube of the recounting of the oath, as I have done 200 or 300 times, Roberts basically says it to him as a question, so help you God. And Roberts says, and Obama says, so help me God. But, I mean, it just shows that the more you sort of go into the minutiae of this stuff, the less clear some of it becomes.
You talk about the president being a very polite man, but when they start doing that second oath, there is that moment where the president says, we'll take it slow. Now, you could interpret it, he was saying that to himself, but it seemed like you were saying he's also saying it to Roberts.
Right. I mean, you know, there was some edge the second time it was done, the January 21st at the White House map room. Obama was not happy to redo it. He didn't need this complication. And look, Obama knew that Roberts was not his political ally. I certainly don't think Obama believed, and I certainly don't believe, that Roberts did anything to undermine the original oath. That is a conspiracy theory that I reject in its entirety. But it was a slight embarrassment to them both. And again, the experience between the two of them at the beginning of the Obama presidency seemed to me a good metaphor for the tension that would recur over the next 4 years.
Jeffrey Toobin is author of a new book on the Obama White House and the Supreme Court. It's called The Oath. He is senior news analyst at CNN, contributing staff writer at The New Yorker. This is a book about some momentous decisions, Citizens United, the Affordable Care Act, gun control, civil rights, school desegregation. You write about the personalities of all these folks, and just real quick, I just wanted to ask a few questions. You talk about Roberts' path to the Supreme Court. You also seem to be comparing his path to Elena Kagan's path. Were they both astute observers of the political process that is involved in getting to the Supreme Court?
Very much so. Justices don't run for office the way politicians do, but they certainly make themselves are highly aware of what makes a Supreme Court justice and how you position yourself. And both Roberts and Kagan, in very similar ways, put themselves in line to be named to the Supreme Court. You know, ever since Robert Bork, there has been a premium on nominees who don't have extensive paper trails, who can't be tarred with sort of views that senators might use as an excuse to vote against them. At the same time, the justices have to be known well enough so that the president will have confidence in how they'll actually vote. So you have to be partisan without seeming partisan. And both Roberts and Kagan are extremely astute politicians in their own way and manage that interesting tightrope walk of being partisan without seeming partisan, and thus were both confirmed rather easily and have turned out to be precisely as they seemed they were going to be, which is strong conservative and a strong liberal.
How much influence does Antonin Scalia have in shaping the debates and the discussions once the court takes up an issue?
A lot. I mean, he's a very influential justice. He has brought the whole idea of originalism, which is the idea that the Constitution should be interpreted as the framers of the Constitution understood it in the 18th century. That's been a big change in how the Constitution is interpreted. He doesn't win all the time, but certainly when you compare how influential he is now compared to when he arrived in 1986, it's the story of enormous influence.
And yet you tell the story in this book of how it was the NRA in 1977 which took it upon itself to reinterpret the way the court saw the Second Amendment, and that had it seen the Second Amendment all the previous 200 years?
Right. Well, Scalia's view is that the court had gotten it wrong for 200 years. And, again, this is where a political agenda and a legal agenda can seem identical. How much of originalism is really just an opportunity for justices to enact the Republican agenda using legal mumbo jumbo? I mean, that's a question that, you know, I sort of leave hanging in the book. But certainly his reinterpretation of the Second Amendment is one that both furthers his view of how the Constitution should be interpreted and perhaps coincidentally also advances the Republican political agenda.
Well, since we've seen the country change so much since it began, where do you think John Roberts or Antonin Scalia want to reset the Supreme Court? Pre-progressive era?
Well, I think it depends on the subject. But, you know, yes, I think in many respects, pre-progressive era. I you know, certainly in terms of additional scrutiny of Congress's power to pass laws, that was certainly evident in the Affordable Care Act case. Limiting the ability of race to be used. I don't think their view of Brown v. Board of Education is that race simply cannot be considered under any circumstances, even to ameliorate conditions that have existed for a long time, or to preserve diversity, which they don't think is a legitimate goal. I think they want to do away with a lot of the cases that put up the barriers between church and state, which are very much the result of the Warren Court. And same, of course, for abortion. You know, the idea that abortion is not a protected right is an article of faith among conservatives now.
One of the pressures that you write about and that's talked about, President Obama talks about, is better to then make the changes in the Constitution. But the court, with amendments or with laws, if the court decides not to second-guess legislative direction, which is what you say, in a sense, John Roberts did when upholding the Obamacare ruling, that they were going to let it play out in politics rather than in the courts. Is that something that both sides can use, turn to the electorate, turn to the legislative process, and sidestep or ignore the courts?
Well, this gets to the question of judicial activism and judicial restraint. It used to be conservatives who talked about judicial restraint and liberals who were judicial activists. What we've seen in the Roberts Court is a sort of switching of places where you have conservative judicial activism. Conservatives overturning the will of the voters, whether it's gun control in District of Columbia and Chicago, or you know, most prominently, the will of the elected officials in the McCain-Feingold law with Citizens United. This is a big change from recent history.
And what's the difference in the Commerce Clause today with the ruling on the Affordable Care Act? How will it be interpreted down the line, do you suppose? You write that it was a shot across the bow, but is it more than that?
It's a shot across the bow. You know, I have my doubts of how much it will actually limit Congress in the exercise of its Commerce Clause power. I think this case was so much tied to the fact that it required individuals to make a purchase, to go into commerce, that I don't know that there will be a lot more. I think it's a shot across the bow is correct. It's a warning, but it is not it's not really shutting Congress down.
You don't see them using that as an activist to further find ways to where Congress has expanded the Commerce Clause to restrict it.
I don't think so, but I raise it as a possibility. I don't know.
Because you do say, Jeffrey Toobin, that in some ways you see this as inoculating the court after Bush v. Gore and Citizens United, inoculating the court from accusations of politics so that John Roberts
I do, definitely,
can continue
that.
An agenda. following an agenda.
Oh, very much. Oh, very much. I think that's the case. I thought you were talking about the Commerce Clause particularly. Roberts very much was worried about the court being seen as unduly political, and that was clearly on his mind in how he saved the Affordable Care Act. But as we look ahead, I don't think John Roberts has discovered his inner moderate. He is definitely going to be the same conservative he's always been.
Which cases are you looking for in this session that you're going to try to see, what is revealed?
Well, I think the affirmative action case in the University of Texas, the future of the Voting Rights Act, and it will be very interesting. We don't know if they're going to take either of these cases, but the Defense of Marriage Act case and the Proposition 8 case out of California are both obviously very, very important.
And as Antonin Scalia said, the constitutionalist writers didn't say anything about same-sex marriage or gay marriage in the text. I believe I saw
I don't think his vote is. I don't think his vote is much in doubt in that case.
That's Jeffrey Toobin. He is an author, a lawyer, regular contributor to The New Yorker and CNN. His new book is The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. Jeffrey Toobin is speaking tonight at Benaroya Hall. You got a preview of his conversation. Just by the way, as you'll get a post view of another conversation, Andrei Kudrescu is going to be on our show tomorrow, the poet and writer, and he's always great. But you can see him tonight. He's in Seattle to speak at Seattle's Town Hall at 7 p.m., so you can get a double dose of Kudrescu as well.
Just to go and listen to the accent, I think, is worthwhile.
Yeah, Kudrescu's always so insightful and fun. So that was Jeffrey Toobin. You know, you will be able to track what's happening in the Supreme Court with Nina Totenberg, with all the reports that come out of public radio, with the people we call up as this court's session unfolds. And you know you can because you rely on this public radio service, and you know you will get quality news and information about the Supreme Court. You'll be informed, you'll get the background, and you'll be able to look ahead. That's why you listen, and that is why we ask you to support it. It's as simple as that. We need to raise $19,000 for weekday by 11. We have to be halfway there, at least, by 10 o'clock, and we'll do that with your call of support at 206-543-9595, 1-866-677-5869. You have moved from the, who'd you work for before NPR?
Weren't you? ABC News.
ABC News. So, you're with the big boys.
Yeah,
And women.
Yeah, and it's a whole different world, and I love KUOW. I love working here. It's so much nicer. Don't tell anyone that.
But. I'm not gonna because you were in Beijing, you were in with ABC, and then you decided.
Yeah,
I decided
to come back to where I started my career in a small public radio station, large public radio station, and
which was
I remember
that one?
Doing pledge. Well, WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts.
Oh, no
I remember
kidding.
That's where I learned how to do pledge drives. And speaking of which, we are in a pledge drive, if you hadn't noticed. And we need your calls, 206-543-9595. Steve, a bunch of people have called this morning. Leah from Seattle is a new member, so you need to ring that bell. Ring the new member bell, Steve.
Oh, I'm sorry. There you go.
Because we're ringing the bell for new members. We love hearing from folks who are pledging for the first time because that's how we grow our audience. That's how we grow KUOW, by bringing in new members. Nathan writes he's been listening to KUOW since he was a baby, virtually, and even in college in Canada, he listened on his computer. And Kevin writes he loves listening during the commute, especially Marketplace. Thanks to all of you. You can join these folks, these fine folks, and your friends and your neighbors who have already pledged by calling 206-543-9595.
I like these two related comments. You read that one.
Oh, yeah.
In front of your
screen. So Anne just moved to Seattle from Los Angeles, and she says, we've been supporting KPCC, which is a great radio station, and are very happy now to support KUOW. We care about public media.
And here's what Marco wrote. I pledged online at KUOW.org. I moved to Seattle from Germany. At first, I really dreaded turning on the radio. It's changed when I discovered KUOW with its many great programs, This American Life, Radio Lab, and fact-based reporting. Thank you, Danke. That's what he said. I mean, because you rely on public media, on public broadcasting around the country and around the world, and it exists because you here at KUOW, you support it. You support it at 206-543-9595. You pledge $150 for a year's worth of great public radio service, and you know that pledge goes into the system, which supports streaming across the world, which supports other great radio stations and other great radio shows. So we really would like to hear from you right now on this Wednesday. 206 206-543-9595, 1-866-677-5869. Give us a call.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Repertory Theater, kicking off its 50th anniversary season with Pullman Porter Blues by Cheryl L. West, featuring a live blues band, playing September 27th through October 28th. Tickets at seattlerep.org.
KUOW and Jet City Improv present Election Show 2012, a nonpartisan political comedy where the candidates, issues, and political parties are chosen by the audience. Selected Thursdays and Fridays now through November 2nd and on election night. Jet City Improv. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
Support for KUOW comes from the law offices of Hillis, Clark, Martin, and Peterson. For over 40 years, HCMP has been connecting clients to a broad range of business, real estate, and litigation solutions. Hillis, Clark, Martin, and Peterson, HCMP.com.
All right, we're going to shake things up, move things along a little bit with the blues, my friends, because we got a chance to talk to the great Buddy Guy a couple months ago now. Buddy Guy came up playing with Howling Wolf, with Muddy Waters, with Coco Taylor. He was a session man in Chicago in the late 50s, early 60s. He was just a little kid on his own in the South, and he had a he saw some guy playing the guitar, and he decided to try to make one, and he went back home, and he tried to make a guitar out of anything he could think of, wire from a fence, all sorts of stuff. So when we talked to him back in August, he had just written a book, When I Left Home, and I asked him to tell the story of how he got his second real guitar.
My mom and dad and them only had two holidays when you're on a plantation. You know, that's Easter Sunday, come on a Sunday. We did have the Sunday off every week. The only other holiday I knew about was Christmas. So they'd go get this guy with this guitar on Christmas, and he'd come by, and if some kid could afford a toy, which you made your own toy, and they'd be playing, and we did a lot of shooting firecrackers on Christmas and Christmas Eve. That was our Christmas. And no Christmas trees or something like that. And they'd go get this guy, and he'd come by at my dad's house, and they'd drink up the case of beer, one case of beer and a gallon of wine, and go to your parents' house and do the same thing all Christmas Day, and that's it until next Christmas. And when the guitar player would get kind of drunk and put the guitar down, all the rest of the kids was playing, I would go get the guitar and try to figure it out. And my dad finally got one from him. He had two. We had two strings on it, and I went to Baton Rouge to try to go to high school.
Yeah, you were playing a two-string guitar, and you played it on your sitting down, right?
Yeah. What it was, I couldn't afford the guitar string. There wasn't no guitar strings out there where I was born at, so I would take any kind of wire I could get, and hopefully I could stretch it tight enough to hear it. And this stranger walked by one Thursday, Friday evening and said, "Son, I see you sitting there every evening. I bet if you had a guitar, you would learn how to play." And I said, "I guess so," because I didn't know who he was, you know. And he come by that Saturday, I think, Friday or Saturday, and said, "You ready? Ready for what? I'm going to buy you a guitar." And that's how I got my 46 string.
I just think that is about, you tell the story in the book, in Buddy Guy, When I Left Home, you tell that story about this is tight-knit community. In the end, this was somebody that was...
My dad knew.
That your dad knew. But he didn't know that at the time. He was just being neighborly, with 50 bucks, with real money.
Yeah. Well, everybody back then in Baton Rouge, you know, and where I was born at and all that, we didn't have door locks and things like that. And you couldn't get nobody to go in your mom's house. You could leave the door open and wouldn't nobody go there if you're not there, because the neighbor a mile away would start screaming, "Ain't nobody at home, don't go there," you know. The dog would bark, and you say, "You better not go in there." So... And when my dad first finally got a raggedy car, we never did have to take the key out of the ignition or wind the windows up and let it rain, because you couldn't get nobody. Now you can't put the car in the house, which is somebody stealing.
You know, a big contrast then to come to Chicago off that train and trying to find a place to live in that big city.
And didn't know anybody. I knew one guy who had left Baton Rouge. He the one told me to come there and look for a job. I was working at LSU. And he said you could work at a college in a university in Chicago, make three times the money, which you could. And then you could go hear Muddy and Walton and play.
Which is what you wanted to do.
That's what I wanted to do, watch them. So if I did learn how to play, I could be done got it from the horse's mouth, you know, not because I finally got old. old phonograph played at 78s, and you try to figure out. We didn't have television, nothing. You could look and say, oh, I see what his fingers did or something like that. So when I got to Chicago, I'm like saying, oh, okay, here I am, you know. And I didn't go there to be answering your questions yet, because I didn't ever think I was good enough.
Yeah, I know you talk about that.
Yeah.
Good thing other people thought
still,
so.
Still don't, yeah, because I tell people right now, if you try to satisfy yourself, you're never satisfied. I tell a lot of girls and women I know, daughters and aunties and stuff, I say, when they made a mirror, they messed up, because everybody looks in the mirror and think I should look better. They start brushing and combing and stuff like that. And music is the same way. If you try to please yourself, and I got this from B.B. King. We were talking one day. He said, buddy, I never made a record I like. I said, well, maybe I should sell my guitar now then.
But that's not what he meant.
I don't know. He said he never made one he liked.
Well, you talk about it. You didn't like a lot of the early records you made.
No, you know, that's what I'm. That's why I made that comment.
Yeah.
You know, you never satisfied. You know, even when you put on a shirt, you turn sideways. If you try it on, you turn left, you turn right. And I don't know what you're looking for, you know. And when you get in the mirror to comb your hair, when I had hair, you just keep combing and you look and you look and you It's like a camera. A camera only take what it see. Some people say, I don't like that picture. That camera took what it saw.
All right, so given that, why was it so important for you to be a blues musician? What was it that was driving you? Because if it wasn't the desire for fame, and it wasn't the belief that, you know, you had something great, what was driving you?
I think it's a God-gifted thing. You know, I was brought up in a church. That's all we had. We didn't have instruments. It was all voices. I don't know if you can go back and remember Lou Rawls, Johnny Taylor, Mahalia Jackson, all those, several of them was before those guys. They didn't have drums and keyboards and things. They had the original Five Blind Boys. It's just five guys, and the other voice was in harmony. And that's when the guitar was kind of obsolete, because it wasn't electrified until Les Paul and Leo Fender came along, and then B.B. King came along and bent the strain and sent the guitar. I'd tell him every time I see him, now it wouldn't be for him. I could go to the store and just buy a guitar. After he made 3 o'clock in the morning, you had to get a job and buy the guitar on time. And it's something I think we all put here for a reason, not a season. Because when I taught myself how to play a guitar, by the way, I didn't learn nothing in school and no book.
No, you taught yourself.
Yeah.
You don't read music, right?
No. And I just was. It was like, if you could play the guitar, can't nobody else do it. It's like a sore thumb. And I didn't see, you couldn't say, well, if I could learn how to play the guitar pretty well, I could be talking to you today and don't have to sleep in the house like my mom there with a bucket in the middle of the floor to catch the rain because it was leaking, and make a decent living at it. And all of a sudden I woke up one day and the British guys had an exploded and came to America and made B.B., Mudd, and all us make a little money.
Well, you know, that story is often told, and you're part of that story. I mean, you go to Chicago, you guys are making the blues, you were creating American music, right, at that time, and then you start losing your audience.
Yes.
Because people are listening to the Isley Brothers, they're going to Motown.
Right.
You were wondering if you were going to make it as a musician at that point.
Well, I didn't dream of this anyway. I was playing it for the love of music.
You were a tow truck driver.
Right. And these people was playing it for the love of money. And if you go beyond me, I had the opportunity to play with the guy who kind of taught Muddy Waters, Son House. And as I said earlier, they all was just playing for the love of music, a drink of whiskey, and a good-looking woman, and that was your pay. So then all of a sudden, the British guys really brought us out. You know, I didn't know B.B. King tell me all the time, you know, hey, I was making it from town to town when he was making those hit records, because it was being ripped off by record companies and everything else who could get you that had the hit and fine print on you, you know, and you just couldn't figure out what they were doing. The record company was getting rich. Managers, I have people laughing. I think Elvis would have lived a little longer if he hadn't found out the Colonel was making more money than he was.
I want to play a song. This is a song that you did with Junior Wells, yeah. And then you got credit for it. You wrote this song as well. This is We're Ready. In this book, Buddy Guy, when I left home, you said that you did a lot of great music with Junior Wells, but that you thought that the music that you did on this album and was some of your best. What was it that Buddy Guy and Junior Wells had together that made it such a tight musical sound?
You know, to be honest with you, we didn't know we were doing it. Until the British guys came back and said, wow, you know, this is including Hendrix, you know, and we were just playing. Like I said, we was following Sunhouse and Muddy Water. Now, we play well enough, you get a good-looking girlfriend, and maybe you get you a bottle of beer.
And you guys were, you were young men, right? You were, what, in your 20s, early
30s? 21 or 22.
Yeah.
And
so that's what you would be doing if you're in your 20s.
No, I didn't even drink still nasty. And I was kind of shy, and Muddy Waters and him taught me how to drink that glass of wine and told me, say, boy, if you drink that wine, you'll turn them on, you know, you'll put on that show. Because when I went to Chicago, I only had saw one guitar player that put on the show. That was a late Guitar Slim. T-Bone would put it behind his head, but... and then I figured out how to play it behind my back and all that. I couldn't compete with those great guitar players like Earl Hooker, Matt Murphy, Wayne Bennett, and all those guys. Oh, there was 1,000 of them in Chicago. So I said, man, you better figure out something else to get some attention. And that's what I was trying to do when I would jump off the stage. I went there with a 100-foot lead wire, and even Hendrix asked me, what was that? How can you make sound come through that much lead wire? But I got that from the late Guitar Slim.
You would start out in the parking lot sometimes.
Yes. You'd
start out in your car sometimes,
yeah.
In the parking lot.
Especially if it was snowing. That's when I can get some attention, because I just plug it up and come in the door. I had saw Slim do that in Louisiana, but he didn't come in the snow. So every time we used to have a battles of guitars, I'd say, just plug me up in the car. I'm coming in the door. I can't outplay these guys, but I can outdo them.
That is a great Buddy Guy, and this is a great Buddy Guy playing a tribute to Stevie Ray Vaughan. You know, that was a treat.
Mm.
That was a privilege, being able to sit across the table with Buddy Guy and talk to him about his career and his music and why he is driven to do it. And it was back in August, and if that was a treat for you, hearing that whole interview that we did with him and being able to... share the music and hear him, I hope that you will now be reminded of that. That's why we play these, and remind you that this is what Weekday and Public Radio in general is all about, is we get to hear these guys for a little chunk of time and have them tell stories. Deborah Wong and I are hoping that you appreciate that, and we would like to hear from you. We need to get to $19,000 by 11 o'clock. We get there with your phone call. If you haven't yet committed to public radio, this is a great time to do it at 206-543-9595. Pledge $250 for a year's worth of great programming. Pledge at 1-866-67-5869. You can pledge $100. It's what you can afford, what you think it's worth. but knowing that we need your help to support this service.
We've heard from a lot of folks this morning. Thanks for all of your calls. Lisa from Bellevue called to renew. Megan called to renew. She says she can't live without KUOW. She drives around all day listening to it. I bet that describes a lot of you out there who might be stuck in your cars at the moment, but you've got KUOW to keep you company. And Leslie from Vashon called to become a new member. We're going to ring that bell. Because
you like that bell.
We love new members. I mean, we love all of our members, but you know, the great thing about new members is this is how we grow our audience at KUOW. This is how we grow the institution. And it's not that easy to become a new member. I mean, if you've been listening for a while, maybe you don't have that habit of calling up during the pledge drive. You just kind of listen, wait for the pledge drive to finish, and then, you know, go on with your life. But when you make that step, you make that leap, you say, you know, one day you just wake up and say, I'm going to do it. I'm going to become a new member by calling 206-543-9595. And you just feel differently about the shows that you hear.
You know, a new member means that you have joined a huge community of people who are already part of this community. Your call right now, that is important. We try to make that point that it is you we're talking to, because you are the person who is listening, has not yet become a new member, and you make that call, you have that change, you have that impact. 206-543-9595. It's pretty quick. You're on and off pretty quick with these volunteers. You're listening to 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. We have to get to halfway by 10:01, Deborah. So we need about $2,000, 20 folks calling at the $100 level. We can do that. Let's fill these phones.
That'll do it. And we've got a whole room full of volunteers downstairs that just went down there, and it's a bunch of cheerful folks who I recognize, a lot of them, people who are just passionate about KUOW and who come back every single time, every single pledge drive, they're down.